Okay, so I just start.
Yep.
Good afternoon, everybody. So we have a 1 hour of time to go through. Hopefully this screen is going to be okay with me. So I'm going to talk about prevention, chemo prevention. There's a difference between prevention and chemo prevention, okay? And I'm at the pharmacology department. In fact, my own research right now is really about cancer treatment, not prevention. But I spent a lot of time in the prevention department here at Roswell doing chemo prevention. That's why I'm still talking about it. So today we are going to cover four topics. Why cancer prevention? I guess it's obvious to you why we need a cancer prevention. And I'm going to talk about what is cancer prevention, and then what is cancer chemo prevention. And finally, it's going to be something about the current status of cancer chemo prevention. So let's look at the cancer rates globally. So this is data actually from 2012 worldwide. And so that year there was 14.1 million new cases, 8.2 million cancer deaths. And so this means like 500 people dying every 30 minutes. So that's quite dramatic. 32.6 million people living with cancer within 5 years of diagnosis. The most commonly diagnosed cancers are lung cancer, 13%, breast cancer, 11.9%, colorectal cancer, almost 10%. So this is very different from what we are going to be seeing in the next slide in the U.S. The U.S. cancer is different. The most common cause of death, lung cancer, 19.4%, liver, 9.1%, stomach, 8.8%, which is also different from the cancer in the U.S. About 30% of cancer deaths are due to five leading behavioral or dietary risks. These are high body mass index, low fruit vegetable intake, lack of physical activity, tobacco use, and alcohol use. And I should mention that for people who do both tobacco smoking and alcohol drinking, the cancer risk increased up to 30-fold for mouth cancer, oral cancer, esophageal cancer, maybe some other cancers as well. Tobacco use causes over 20% of global cancer deaths and about 70% of global lung cancer deaths. Everybody knows that tobacco is bad, obviously. About 65% of all cancer deaths occurred in low and middle income countries, which is not difficult to understand either. Projection for 2030. The problem is getting worse. 21.7 million new cases, 13.1 million deaths. So a lot of research is needed for cancer prevention. Here's a look at the U.S. Situation. So this is data going up to 2014. I got it from this paper published last year. And so this is trends in cancer incidence and mortality rates in the U.S. going from 1975 to 2014, 1975 up to 2014. Looking at the rate per 100,000 population, okay, and so at the top is the male incidence, the bottom is the female incidence, the middle one is the combined one, and here are the mortalities. And so if we look at here, over the past decade, overall cancer incidence rate declined by about 2% per year in men, and is stable in women. And in fact, I think now we are beginning to see decline. Since 1990, overall cancer death rate declined per year by about 1.3% in men and 0.9% in women. So this picture is very different from what we just saw globally. Here is a look at the annual age-adjusted cancer incidence rate in the U.S. I'm sorry that your handouts are all black and white. I actually asked you know, to have a colored handouts, but I was told that you have access to the website that you know, the real slides are there, so you can probably help with it. So on this side is a male, and the female is on this side. Looking at the sort of the most common cancers, the prostate in the male is the most common in the U.S. Lung cancer is the second, the colorectal cancer is the third, and there are other cancers there. On the female side, it's the breast cancer, as you may know, followed by lung cancer and the colorectal cancer. You can see that these things are going down in the last decade or so. For some cancers in the female side as well, and the lung cancer is stabilizing and beginning to decline too. But other cancers like melanoma is going up, liver cancer is going up, thyroid cancer on this side is going up, and uterine cancer is stable, not changing much. For the urinary bladder in the male side is also sort of stable, and I should say that bladder cancer is almost fourfold higher in men than in women. I don't know if you guys know that. And tobacco smoke is number one cause of bladder cancer. Here's a look of annual age-adjusted cancer death rates in the United States. So this is a good picture as far as mortality is concerned in terms of the most common cancers. In this case, the male. And so the red is a lung cancer, lung bronchus cancer. And you can see that it's declining last decade or more than decade. The prostate cancer is also declining, and so is the colorectal cancer. And stomach cancer has been declining for many decades. On the female side, number one is lung cancer, but it's also beginning to decline. Breast cancer declining. And so the major ones are actually declining on both sides. But I should mention that in terms of prevention, it's not easy to see the effect of prevention in a population because it takes a long time to see the effect. And so you cannot see something like in cancer treatment. You give a drug, 2 weeks later you can check, see if the tumor is shrinking or not, right? In cancer prevention setting, it takes decades to see the preventive effect. And this is one of the examples. And so tobacco smoke, right? Smoking sort of is pretty sort of common in 40s and 1940s, 1950s, and plateaued along that time. So on this side, it's the percent of adult current cigarette smoker. This one is the lung cancer, and so you can see that increasing, and the plateauing here. But that difference is about 50 years, 40 to 50 years. So take that long time to really see the impact of stop smoking. Or smoking caused cancer. Same story here in the female. In the U.S., smoking plateaued around 1950s, 1960s. And in this figure, the thing is still going up, but we know that it plateaued really in the late 90s or early 2000s, right? And so again, it takes 40 to 50 years to see the impact of tobacco smoke, and you can imagine that the prevention would also take that long to see a big effect. All good news, but cancer is going to be the number one killer in the U.S. It's already number one killer for people younger than 85 years, right? So here used to be cardiovascular disease, and now it's cancer. And on this side, people older than 85 years, it's still heart disease. But I think if you look at the trend, it won't take long for these two lines to cross, right? So here is the summary. For once cancer is diagnosed, for patients with certain cancers, even the most advanced treatment methods often do not save their lives. For example, 5-year survival for lung and pancreatic cancer is only 18%, 8%. In patients with less advanced cancer, treatment still causes high morbidity and also tremendous social economic problems. And so it's better to prevent it in the first place. And this is more sort of data. And so this may be difficult to see, but this figure came from this paper here. And so here is a look at 5-year relative survival by stage at diagnosis and race in the U.S. Going from 2006 to 2012, over 6 years. And so here it's the female breast cancer, colorectal cancer, esophageal cancer, so on and so forth. And so it's color-coded, it's sort of all races and this, and white and the black, and in most cases the white, the blacks are doing worse. But also, if the cancer has distal metastasis, then it's pretty dismal in almost all cases. And in some cancers, if you can see it, the liver cancer and pancreatic cancer, pretty scary. Once diagnosed, the prognosis is very, very bad. I'm sure you've seen something like this before in your class. Cancer cells are hard to kill, right? Why they are hard to kill? Because they have unlimited replicative potential, self-sufficiency in growth signals, insensitivity to anti-growth signals, evading apoptosis, sustained angiogenesis, and tissue invasion and metastasis. The last one is the most dangerous one. If the tumor doesn't move, it won't be too much of a problem. We can use surgery to remove it. If it metastasizes, then that's very difficult to deal with, right? And so here, then it comes to carcinogenesis. So why cancer is so difficult to kill? Why they are, you know, getting all these capabilities? Different from the normal cell. And so the carcinogenesis is about transformation of a normal cell to a malignant cell and to metastasis. And so this is basically a clonal selection expansion, multi-year, multi-stage, multi-pass. And this is initiated or caused by chemicals, radiation, biological agents, even random, right, in your basement. And so if we look at the bottom, these kind of changes, can involve activation of proto-oncogenes, right, or inactivation of tumor suppressor genes, or disturbance of proliferation, apoptosis. Those is more like epigenetic changes. And so goes from normal cells, initiated cells, pre-malignant cells, malignant cells, and then the doctor says the patient got a cancer. That's a clinical diagnosis of cancer, and then the cancer may metastasize. So this process, again, is a multi-year, multi-stage, multi-pass process, and yet the journey of a malignant transformation against host defense is not an easy one, right? Only the cell that can really achieve the growth advantage can fight off the surveillance or defense by the host, can really grow and proliferate. And I should mention that in many cases, this is a silent process. It can take place in our body. We don't feel it, right? We don't know that until all of a sudden something comes up and you go to a doctor and doctor says, my goodness, you got some kind of cancer. And that is here. That is here. It's too late. And so detection is very important because it's a silent, in most cases, unless it's skin cancer, you can see it, right? If it's like liver cancer or even lung cancer, you cannot really see it. So it's very difficult to tell whether you know there is a cancer developing in our body. And I should say that this process probably is taking place in everybody. It just maybe it's very slow that we never get a cancer, and so we could be, if the carcinogenesis is something like a disease, right? I mean, you know, it's, we have it, we just don't know it, and one day we die with carcinogenesis, or maybe, you know, sort of a cancer which is not bothering us, instead of dying of cancer. And so in cancer prevention, this one concept is very important, that somehow we can delay the cancer for a few years so that we can live with it, we can die with it, but not die from it, right, or die of it. So that's, you know, that's the really the essence of prevention. We are not talking about totally stop cancer, which is impossible to use prevention to really stop it. I don't think that's going to be easy to do. I happen to think it's impossible. And here is the molecular changes. This is an old paper, 2006. You guys probably can find a better one. I didn't check, but it gives you the point. And so if you look at the top, so again, this is like last slide. It goes from normal to initiated, and then the sort of pre-cancer and several stages here, mild, moderate, and severe. And this is called intraepithelial neoplasia, IEN. And then to CIS or CIS, this is carcinoma in situ. That's the tumor that's still in the epithelium, right? It's still there, didn't move. And then, if we don't do anything, it's going to become a real cancer and can metastasize. And if you look at these different cancers here, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and so on and so forth, you see different molecular changes at different stages, okay? And those are the sort of the drivers that actually sort of push the cells toward this side, the direction. And so, what is causing cancer? And I put this slide here, cancer-causing factors, everything, unfortunately. What do you eat? Carcinogen-contaminated food, right? Everybody likes grilled food, like, you know, grill. And do you know that the grilled food is loaded with carcinogen? A carcinogen called a FIP, which is actually produced from high heat cooking of meat. In some countries, even like in China, the high humidity and high temperature is a good environment for some fungus to grow. And one kind of fungus makes aflatoxin. Aflatoxin is a strong liver carcinogen. And so in some parts of China, where liver cancer is very high, incidence is very high. So things like that. What do you drink, right? Alcohol is carcinogen, and carcinogen-contaminated water, right? Like arsenic-contaminated water in some places. What do you inhale? Tobacco smoke, polluted air, right? Or even if there's radon in the basement, that's bad too, right? And so all kind of things we can inhale. Even sunshine is bad. So I lived in Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, for 2 years. And I realized at that time that too much sunshine is not very good. You know, we look here in Buffalo, we look for sunshine. But in Tucson, Arizona, every day is a sunshine day. And temperature goes very high. And if you look at the skin cancer incidence in the U.S., Right? The Arizona state is the highest state in terms of skin cancer incidence, very much like Australia. And hiding in sunshine is the UVA, UVB. These are just the different wavelengths UV, and they cause skin cancer. Medicine, many cancer treatment drugs are actually cancer-causing drugs, and it's the carcinogens themselves, right? Radiation clearly is DNA damaging, can cause cancer later. Infection, right? Hepatitis B and C virus, liver cancer. Human papilloma virus, cervical cancer, right? Epstein-Barr virus, lymphoma. Helicobacter pylori, stomach cancer. Schistosome, bladder cancer. So all kinds of worms, bugs can cause cancer. Germline mutation, and you guys must have heard many of those stories before. And I just put here APC, that which is linked to colon cancer. Right? The risk of colon cancer, if the guy is carrying APC mutation, the risk of colorectal cancer by age 40 is 100%. Random mutations during DNA replication in stem cell, and so this is, there's nothing we can do about it, right? It's a random. It causes mutation because of DNA replication, but many of those we can do about. And so take cigarette smoking as an example. So here is the carcinogenesis, why cigarette smoking is so bad, because it has a nicotine in it. Nicotine is going to get the person hooked with smoking, right? Because it's nicotine addiction. Addiction, I'm sorry, that's a mistyped addiction. And so, but coming together with nicotine in the tobacco smoke are the carcinogens. There are at least two classes of carcinogens. The pH is polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. Or the NNK, this is nitrosamine. The full name is down here. Now those things, when they get into our body, the cells try to get rid of them, right? Try to metabolize them, and they are pro-carcinogens. They themselves are not actually bad, but the cell tries to metabolize and get rid of it, but some of the enzymes actually will activate it, right? And so once it activates, I call the metabolic activation, it's going to attack the nucleophiles, including DNA, and cause DNA sort of miscoding, right? So changes, mutations in key genes, and that's going to eventually cause cancer. And so that's how this is sort of going repeatedly in tobacco smokers, right? And here is a look at the difference. So effects of smoking cessation on lung cancer risk. So if we say the current smoker, the relative risk is 1, men and women, and here is 2 to 9 years sort of stop smoking, and longer and longer and longer. And if you look at the non-smoker, the difference from here to here is like what, 20, I have a calculation here, let me just, I think it's a 25-fold or something. Yeah, 25-fold, and on this side for women, between the current smoker and non-smoker is 9-fold. So just by not smoking, that we can reduce lung cancer that much. Now, in addition to avoiding exposure to carcinogens, cancer risk can be reduced by employing intervention measures. And here are a few examples. The first one is HPV. They have human papilloma virus vaccine prevents cervical cancer. This was published 10 years ago or 11 years ago. So, and this is now FDA approved use. So background and study design. HPV types, there are many types of HPV. Types 16, 18 cause approximately 70% of cervical cancer in humans. In a randomized double-blind trial involving women of 15 to 26 years of age without prior HPV infection, a quadrivalent vaccine against HPV types 6, 11, 16, 18 was given at day 1, month 2, month 6, and then subjects were followed for 3 years. And here's a look at the outcome. And they look at the early stage cancer, the adenocarcinoma in situ, associated with these two types of HPV. And the vaccine group, the placebo group, and they start with similar number of testing subjects. The case with this adenocarcinoma in situ is 1 here and 42, so this is pretty dramatic, right? Plus the cancer prevention trial, it's called PCPT trial, utilizing finasteride. And so, background, androgens are involved in prostate cancer development. Everybody knows that. Finasteride is an inhibitor of 5-alpha reductase, which inhibits the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, the active one, the more active one, or the main androgen in the prostate. And so in this case, in this trial, the finasteride 5 mg per day was given to men at age 50 years or older for 7 years. And so here we look at the outcome. Finasteride group, placebo group, this is about 30% decrease in prostate cancer incidence in the intervention group. The problem with this drug is it cause a higher grade of cancer this drug is causing higher grade of cancer even though it reduced the total cancer incidence by 30%. And so FDA never approved this, but you can see the effect with this drug, right? Celecoxib reduced colon cancer risk. And so COX-2, cyclooctonase 2, is involved in colon cancer development. And COX-2 is an enzyme that actually converts sort of the arachidonic acid in a cell to prostaglandin, right? Some kind of prostaglandin. And so celecoxib is a so-called selective COX-2 inhibitor because there are two kinds of COX-2, right? COX-1 and COX-2. And COX-1 is very important in GI tract epithelium, normal physiology, so if you inhibit both, it might cause side effects. And so inhibiting COX-2 is better because COX-2 is normally not expressed or significantly expressed in normal tissues, but overexpressed in cancer tissue. So in this experiment, the celecoxib was given at 16 milligram per kilogram body weight daily for 3 months to children of age 10 to 14 years with APC gene mutations, because I mentioned earlier, for people who have APC gene mutations, which is tumor suppressor, that by age 40, everybody gets colon cancer, colorectal cancer. And so here they tested on these kids, and they look at the baseline, right, the number of polyps in the colon. And so the placebo, celecoxib, starting similarly, and then at the end of study, they look at the number and very different, right? They look at the change in polyp numbers. This is sort of one's sort of plus, the other one's minus. Same story with the percent change in polyp numbers. And I put here that several other studies show celecoxib or aspirin. Aspirin is the drug that actually inhibits both COX-1 and COX-2, prevents colon cancer. And so celecoxib actually was approved by FDA to prevent colon cancer. For cancer prevention, sort of avoiding exposure to carcinogen or preventive intervention is not just everything about cancer prevention. So I put here three sort of categories, right? Preventive intervention and exposure and detection of cancer. And then down here, is the genetic and environmental factors in cancer health disparity. And people are studying different areas of cancer prevention in every cancer centers. We have people doing everything in every aspect here at Loazo Park. And I think in this class, some faculty members from the prevention department is going to do this here at the bottom, so I'm not going to do this one here. And I will also go very brief with the middle part and focus more on the preventive intervention. But anyway, so detection, I'll just say a few words. Detection, there are different biomarkers used for detection. So like exposure biomarkers, endogenous, exogenous agents, and their metabolites or adducts in tissues, a body product, like carcinogen DNA adducts that one can measure. And then the susceptibility biomarkers, an indicator of like heritable ability of an individual to respond to the challenge of a carcinogenic agents or events. And we know like GST, glutathione transferase P, is null in prostate cancer, right? APC is inactivated in colon cancer, right? So these kind of mutations makes the patient susceptible to different kind of cancer. Cancer biomarkers, so this is about detecting cancer. So predict future cancer development or suggest a potential presence of cancer. So there are different biomarkers. The phenotypic biomarkers like the colorectal adenoma. So those are sort of only adenoma. They are not cancer, right? Actinic keratosis, which is sort of the precursor to skin cancer. And then molecular biomarkers, right? Like CA125 and PSA, everybody heard about PSA for prostate cancer. CA125 is for like ovarian cancer, but those things are not very specific. Inflammation, tissue inflammation can also elevate it. For instance, PSA in BPH or prostate inflammation, and same story with the CA125. Then the cell-free DNA in blood. And there is a fancy name for it. It's called a liquid biopsy. I'm sure you guys heard it, right? So looking for DNA in the blood for detection of cancer or other specimens. So I put the example here. In 2014, FDA approved the Cologuard, the first stool-based test that detects the presence of red blood cells and certain DNA mutations associated with colorectal cancer. And this is sort of information about some of the American Cancer Society guidelines for the early detection of certain cancers. So breast cancer, right? Yearly mammogram at age 40 and later. Clinical breast cancer, breast exam about every 3 years, starting age 20. And every year start at age 40. Colon rectal cancer, everybody needs to do a colonoscopy when they get to age 50. And then afterwards, 10 years, every 10 years. For the flexible sigmoidoscopic examination, which is every 5 years starting age 50, right? Cervical cancer, Pap test every 3 years at age 21 to 29, and this test is for every 5 years at age 30 to 65, plus HPV test. Prostate cancer used to be annual PSA and digital rectal examination for the prostate age 50 or older. Men at higher risk, for instance, African Americans should begin testing at age 45 or older. But now there is this concern of over detection, over screening. And so I think last year or year before last year, ACS, American Cancer Society, puts out here this statement. Atheists believe that man should not be tested without learning about what we know and don't know about the risk of possible benefit of testing and treatment. And this is talking about PSA. And so because of this concern that a lot of breast cancers are pretty slow cancer, they just stay there. So if you don't know about it, it's psychologically beneficial, and maybe you don't need to do treatment. But if you know about it, then you are going to be concerned about it, and the question would be, should I do some kind of surgical removal, stuff like that? And so it could cause over-treatment, and come with it as the side effects of this kind of treatment. And preventive interventions, vaccination, we talk about HPV vaccination, lifestyle changes, very important, physical exercise, eating well, not smoke, right? Those are obvious things. Easy to say, hard to do. Weight control. I'll get to next slide about this weight control. Chemo prevention, and we'll talk about chemo prevention. Weight control. So this is data sort of published a few years earlier, and for information in 2011 or 2012, I got this wrong. And here should be just 25. Take out 29.9, right? It's because this is including both overweight and obese. So 68.5 American adults and 31.8 of children or adolescents were overweight or obese during that period. And 34.9% of American adults and 16.9% of children or adolescents were obese, and that is BMI at 30 kilogram per square meter or higher. Overall, there is no significant change in obesity prevalence in youth or adults between 2003-2004 and 2011-2012, so this is 2011 here. In 2001, experts concluded that the cancers of the colon, the breast, the endometrium, the esophagus, the kidney, the thyroid are associated with obesity. And studies have also shown links between obesity and cancers of the gallbladder, the ovaries, and pancreas. Possible mechanisms that include alterations of a level of sex hormones, sex hormone binding globulins, and other things like insulin and insulin-like growth factor 1. So finally, chemo prevention. So what is chemo prevention? Intervention with pharmaceuticals, vitamins, minerals, biologics, and other chemicals to retard, block, reverse the carcinogenic process. And you may view this as chemotherapy of carcinogenesis, or to prevent cancer recurrence. So I put it here, it's really a preemptive strike against cancer. Right. And so bring back this slide, it's not hard to see that what we can do is chemo prevention, right? Because there are so many steps of carcinogenesis in the carcinogenic process. And so in theory, you can disrupt all these steps, or one of those steps, then you cannot go further, right? And so indeed, there are many targets that you can actually sort of, drug, if the target is druggable. Carcinogen-activating enzymes, like cytochrome P450, carcinogen-detoxifying enzymes, like GST I mentioned earlier, estrogen receptors, androgen receptors, 5-alpha reductase I mentioned earlier, COX-2, and some other targets, right? So this is just a part of it. And there are drugs to do this. So some of the agents that have shown chemopreventive activity in clinical trials, like finasteride I mentioned earlier, we'll talk about tamoxifen and raloxifene later, aspirin, like celecoxib I mentioned earlier, against the colorectal cancer, and 13-cis retinoic acid against head and neck cancer, vitamin A, fluorouracil against skin cancer, and the BCG, this is attenuated live bacteria for prevention of bladder cancer recurrence. HPV vaccine, we saw it earlier, against cervical cancer, but maybe also other cancer like oral cancer. And photodynamic therapy, PDT, with fortiflin against red esophagus, which is pre-cancer, cancer to esophageal cancer. And this is FDA-approved agents for treating precancerous lesions or reducing cancer risk. Tamoxifen, raloxifene, again, we'll talk about in a minute. Celecoxib for the, to sort of reduce the polyps in the colon. Fluorouracil, this is actinic keratosis. BCG, the bladder cancer I just mentioned earlier. HPV vaccine, cervical cancer, PDT against esophageal cancer. And there are a lot of other things, agents that are under development, numerous agents that are at a certain stage of evaluation for cancer chemo prevention. And I put that, sort of divide them into three groups, that vitamins and minerals, like folic acid, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin D, selenium, and calcium. The phytochemicals, like phytoestrogens, like genistein from like soybean, lignans like from flaxseed, carotenoids, glucosinolates from cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, right, cauliflower, stuff like that. Allium, organosulfur compounds like diallyl sulfide from garlic, right? Flavonoids from tea and nuts. And drinking tea is well known to be cancer preventive. They are loaded with flavonoids. Phenolics like curcumin, which is very common sort of a flavor in India cooking, right? Terpenoids like limonene and related compounds in orange skin and the lemon, right? Dietary fibers is also cancer preventive. Eat a lot of, fibers like vegetables. It's good for you. And then synthetic chemicals like, NSAIDs. So-called modulators of estrogen receptor signaling. We'll come to it very soon. Tamoxifen and raloxifene and vitamin A and D and so on and so forth. So there are three, many of those compounds are under development. And I put this sort of statement here. Because chemopreventive agents are used in healthy people, meaning these people don't think they have cancer, even though there may be carcinogenesis going on in the body. And so it's high risk subjects or even the general population, and require chronic administration. It is widely suggested that non or minimal drug toxicity is allowed. You cannot give a toxic drug to a patient for cancer prevention. But in reality, FDA has approved drugs for cancer prevention which have significant toxicities, and we'll see it in tamoxifen. So here's a case of tamoxifen. Tamoxifen was discovered as an anti-estrogen compound in 1962 by this company, and tamoxifen has been used for over 30 years in patients with early stage breast cancer as adjuvant therapy to prevent breast cancer recurrence, or in those with metastatic breast cancer to slow growth of the cancer. So this is about treatment. And then because of the efficacy, then there was the NCI, National Cancer Institute, sponsored the breast cancer chemo prevention trial. And so this is a study of tamoxifen initiated in early 1990s based on the clinical efficacy. As an ER-positive breast cancer therapeutic agent. And so before I go further, I just want to put to show that different subsets of breast cancers. So there are four subtypes, right? There's so-called type 1, ER-positive, PR-positive. This is likely to benefit from drugs like, you know, tamoxifen, because the drug is targeting ER, right? And the type 2 is ER positive, ER negative, HER2 positive. So ER is still there, so it may still benefit from drugs like tamoxifen. The type 3 is HER2 positive. HER2 is a receptor tyrosine kinase, right, sitting on the cell membrane. And doesn't have the ER, so this is not going to benefit from that drug. And the type 4 is so-called ER negative, PR negative, and HER2 negative. Everything is negative, it's triple negative. And these cancers are not going to, or patients with these cancers are not going to benefit from hormonal therapy. And so if we look at the estrogen receptor signaling, so this is a very simple cartoon, really. You know a lot more than this, I'm sure. And so just to make you know, a point for the drug, really. And so if we look at the estrogen receptor sitting in the nucleus, right, the receptor, you know, is waiting for the estrogens to come. Okay, so binds to the estrogen receptor, the estrogen, and then it recruits like coactivators and stuff like that, and then it's going to initiate, you know, transcription, right? So that's the basic mechanism. And what the tamoxifen and also the raloxifen does is that it also binds to the estrogen receptor. And so these drugs are called SERMs, selective estrogen receptor modulators. And they bind. If they bind, then the coactivator cannot bind, right? Without the coactivator, the receptor is not going to act like a transcriptional factor, right? So there's no transcription. And so that's how the drug works. And so in this study, this is a big study, costs a lot of money. The question was, does tamoxifen 20 milligram daily reduce the risk of developing breast cancer in a high-risk population of women? And so they really did, you know, sort of a double-blinded, placebo-controlled the study in a lot of women, over 13,000, and this went from 1992 to 1997. It has to be 35 years or older, and this involved 300 centers in the U.S. and Canada. And so there were exclusion criteria listed here. And so here is the outcome, the trial outcome. So reduced invasive breast cancer 45%, ductal carcinoma 48%, bone fracture even stopped, you know, reduced the bone fracture risk, 34%. So that's all very good news. But if you look at the other side, there's an increased 2.4 increase in endometrial carcinoma. Pulmonary embolism increased almost threefold. Deep vein thrombosis increased 1.6-fold. And there are other side effects as well, right? Because the time is getting close, I'm going to just skip this one. This is just the animal study to show that, in fact, the tamoxifen also works against a breast cancer model in mouse, in rats. And so, despite all these side effects, FDA approved tamoxifen in 1998 for reducing incidence of breast cancer in women at high risk for developing breast cancer. And so here are some of the high risk that really need this drug to deal with. A history of breast cancer, 3 to 4-fold increase the risk of developing a new cancer, not a recurrence, a new cancer. Having one first degree relative with breast cancer risk doubles. Having two first degree relatives with breast cancer risk is 5-fold higher. That's pretty bad. Carrying inherited alterations in BRCA1 or BRCA2, up to 80% chance of developing breast cancer. A previous history of atypical hyperplasia, 4 to 5-fold higher risk of developing breast cancer. So you can see that these kind of people need a drug to reduce risk, and tamoxifen is a choice, even though the drug is pretty nasty, causes a lot of side effects, right? And later, actually, people also did a raloxifen trial. And so a similar kind of trial, and the good news is that this drug is also active in terms of reducing breast cancer risk. And so as a result, FDA approved this drug in 2007 in postmenopausal women with high risk for invasive breast cancer. Why postmenopausal women? Because the trial was done in this population, so the drug was approved for this population of people. But in a longer term analysis of this trial, it was found that raloxifene is only 76% as effective as tamoxifene preventing invasive cancer. So nowadays, if people walk into clinic and ask for a drug to prevent, breast cancer, it's normally the tamoxifene is prescribed, not raloxifene. The final slide, I think, and that I just want to mention that there are other approaches for preventing breast cancer. And these are drugs that are used in the clinic to treat. So these are drugs not yet approved for preventing cancer yet. So estrogen receptor downregulators for Vestrant, which binds to the receptor and stabilize the cause to be destroyed. Aromatase inhibitors, right? There are drugs that are actually used in the clinic to treat patients with breast cancer. And this is used in postmenopausal women because estrogen is no longer produced by the ovary in those people, but is converted from androgen by the aromatase. And so to block that is a good idea, right? So that's the end of it. I think I'm just sort of reaching the 1 hour time. Any questions? No questions.
Good.
So I'm going to take a question.